Back to square one, Myanmar back under military rule. Despite a landslide victory in last year's elections, Myanmar's generals have seized power.
The meeting of ministers at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, also known as ASEAN. Why? Well, because recently four pro-democracy activists have been executed. If they protest, they will be hurt.
The struggle between freedom and tyranny is not confined to any one nation or region. It is a global theme that, sadly, is becoming increasingly relevant in our time. Around the world, we are witnessing signs of a rising authoritarianism, along with a concerning suppression of human rights and civil liberties. Yet, we also see the courage of those who choose to resist it. The ongoing fight for democracy and dignity in Myanmar stands as a stark example of this global struggle, illuminating a shared human yearning for freedom, justice, and self-determination. In this way, their fight is everyone's fight. And so with that in mind, let's get into today's show.
I'm Kevin Casasamora. I'm the Secretary General of International IDEA. IDEA stands for International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance.
Thank you. And it's such a pleasure to be talking to you here from your podcast studio in Stockholm. Thank you for inviting me and being welcome to this conversation. I'd like to begin by asking you to introduce International IDEA and its mission to those who may not be familiar with what you do, including its work on democracy and the priorities in the current political landscape, and then also focusing on where you're positioned and what you've been doing in Myanmar specifically.
Of course, gladly. Well, International IDEA is an intergovernmental organization with 35 member states, very diverse crowd because we have member states from all regions, everything from huge democracies like India and Indonesia and Brazil to very small countries like my own. I come from Costa Rica, a highly industrialized, developing the lot. And for 30 years now, because this is our 30th anniversary, the Institute has supported democracy globally in, I would say, two or three ways. I mean, one is by being a policy research institute, working on elections and constitutions and gender issues, regulation of money in politics. A lot of work these days on the impact of digitalization on democracy, climate change and democracy, and also a very strong work stream dedicated to measuring and monitoring the performance of democracies globally. So that's IDEA as a think tank, and we do what think tanks do. We publish reports, we have databases, and so on and so forth. But then there's a second aspect to our work, and arguably at this point is the most important one in some ways, which is the role that we play as providers of technical assistance on those same missions. And in that capacity, we're active, depending on how you count, in between 60 and 70 countries at any given time. And I would say that there's a third role that has also grown in importance over the past few years, which is the role that we play as conveners of political and social dialogues and collective efforts to shore up democracy and also to engage in advocacy. And I would say that at least one part of the work that we're currently doing on Myanmar is connected very clearly to advocating for the democratic struggle of the people of Myanmar. So this is idea in a nutshell. I mean, in the case of Myanmar, well, I mean, we've been engaged in Myanmar and have worked in and on Myanmar for a long time. I mean, although we started working in earnest in 2012, around supporting elections, supporting constitutional processes, supporting the parliament. In some ways, our presence dates back to the early years of this century. I mean, in some ways, we've been there for over 20 years, even before the political opening that happened later. Of course, what used to be our largest and one of our most vibrant national programs in the world changed dramatically when the coup happened. And now our program is very different. I mean, we worked from abroad, but very much in touch with the political forces striving for democracy in Myanmar. And we do several things. I mean, we provide, on the one hand, a tailored and comparative experience on constitutional issues, because a big part of our work is working with democratic, legitimate actors in Myanmar to craft a constitutional settlement for a federal Myanmar. So that's one side of what we do. But then there's the more practical question of providing safe spaces for the pro-democracy movement to meet, both in person and online. And this is something that we are doing on a regular basis, providing civic education and training tools, you know, to many of the people that are working in different ways towards democracy in Myanmar. And last but certainly not least, there's a big component of outreach in international fora, really trying to keep the tragedy of Myanmar on the radar screen of international actors, because there's so much happening around the world, as we know. So there's a real risk that people in other places will forget that this is going on and that this is truly one of the front lines of democracy in the world. Well, we're trying to make sure that people remember that.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And as we discuss your background coming from Costa Rica to being here and working on Myanmar, it also might be a relevant personal anecdote that I personally went from Costa Rica to Myanmar myself, which is kind of interesting. I was a teacher trainer working in a wonderful, very small village in Costa Rica, getting my license from the School of International Training, and was there for the better part of a year, which led me to then work at the American Center in Myanmar. So I had quite the plane trip of transfers and layovers to get from one place to the other.
Well, I hope the little country treated you well.
Pura vida, you know.
Yeah,
that's absolutely.
That's the first thing you learn when you when you live in Costa Rica.
That's about the extent of my Spanish. My Burmese is a little better, but I want to go back to when you were speaking about keeping Myanmar in the forefront of reminding people of the importance of this being the front lines of the battle for democracy and freedom and other things, and in an age of these massive spending cuts that we're seeing and questions about where support is going and what it is that, what is important to keep in focus, there is a sense and a question coming from some quarters of why continue to support Myanmar with all the crisis and the difficulty going on there and what we're seeing. Why keep pouring attention and resources into battling for democracy given the unraveling crisis and where some of the more pessimists might think it's going? And so I'd like to give you a chance to respond to not just why it's important to keep Myanmar in focus in these front lines of democracy, but also why it's so important to counterbalance this argument, why it's so important to continue to highlight what's happening and to continue to stand in solidarity and align with what these democratic actors are trying to do.
Absolutely. I mean, look, because at a fundamental level, any country's struggle for democracy is every country's struggle for democracy. I mean, this is it has become a global issue. And when we go back in time, say a decade, it is remarkable to think that Myanmar was one of the bright spots in a way. Not because democracy was perfect by any stretch there, but it was trending the right way.
Yeah.
And there was real hope that this could turn into something. I mean, given the tragic political history of the country. Same thing with Sudan, where we also had an office. And then all of a sudden, everything started going the wrong way in very dramatic fashion. So at a basic level, I mean, what we're trying to do here is simply to respond to one of the very few pieces of good news that we have in this very bleak landscape that the global state of democracy has become. I mean, we can talk about the negative trends, but one good thing that we know is that in improbable places, the demand for democracy and the will to fight for democracy remains strong. And Myanmar is as clear a case in point about this as I can possibly think of. And this is not theoretical. I mean, for me in particular, I mean, I'm inspired by what I see in my colleagues that come from Myanmar. Almost all of them very young, people that came of age during the political opening in Myanmar, and that they are simply not willing to roll over and accept the military takeover. I mean, this is not something that they are willing to do. That deserves support. It's not the only case, but it's a particularly clear-cut case. I mean, not to speak of the fact that, you know, what happened in Myanmar is, in a way, a throwback to... you know, I come from Latin America, right? So it's a throwback to an age of military takeovers that have become relatively rare. I mean, the way in which democracies are subverted right now is very different. You know, is this kind of the proverbial frog that, you know, slowly boils to death? You know, it's about democratically elected governments that decide to hollow out democracy in a gradual process.
Right.
What happened in Myanmar was not like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a much more brutal
yeah.
a reversal of democracy. And not just that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also what came in the wake of the military takeover. I mean, this is you know, a military force that is indiscriminately killing their own people. Mm-hmm. So one would think that this is as clear a case deserving the support of democratic nations and democratic political forces and Democrats with a small d all over the world as you can possibly, you know, imagine, right? And yet that's not what we're seeing. And it honestly baffles me to some extent, the reluctance on the part of democratic governments around the world to really lend their support in a decisive way to the cause of democracy in Myanmar. Of course, I mean, we can have a longer discussion about the geopolitics involved in all this, but from the standpoint, from the normative standpoint, from the standpoint of values, this is as powerful a case of a democratic struggle worthy of our support as I can possibly think of.
That's a very powerful response. I thank you for that. And if anything, you've just kind of explained in some way the rationale and the mission of our very platform and the very sense that we're trying to give of why this is so important to highlight and pay attention to. And I also, your words recall a recent podcast conversation with James Rodehaver of the UN. We spoke in Bangkok, and he was expressing his frustration that the amount of support that's needed to really make a difference in Myanmar with what the actors are doing and to really see positive results is right there in front of us. Whereas other crises, there's so many resources being poured out where there's not really a good end in sight. And there is an optimistic possibility within reach here if the resources and, you know, in his words, and we hear this a lot, the political will is there to make that happen. And it's just that political will is not present to be able to make the kind of progress that's right in front of us. But I want to segue from talking about the situation in Myanmar and the really vivid imagery that you used of this not being the usual way. It's of the frog that's slowly boiling to death in the water. And this brings up the wider mission of IDEA as well as looking at the global landscape, and that's as we're seeing the global trends of democracy and how they're impacting countries that are transitioning from authoritarianism to democracy and in some way, sadly, slipping down on that other side of the slope with the hollowing out process that you talked about. So moving from looking at Myanmar as a case study to this to the wider global context that IDEA is engaged in, what you're looking at, can you tell us what concerns and trends you're seeing there?
Look, the global trends for democracy are not good, and this is something that we've heard for quite a few years now. But I'll give you a couple of factoids derived from the work that we do, which we usually, the most visible sign of that work is the report that we publish every year, the Global State of Democracy Report, which will come out again this year in September. And it's a fairly comprehensive health check of democracy globally based on a mass of data. And what we see there is that the number of countries, if you take our latest report published at the end of last year, the number of countries whose democratic performance is improving is much lower than the number of countries whose democratic performance is deteriorating. And this is the eighth year in a row in which we see this. And this is the longest sequence that we've seen in the past half a century. Wow. Not just that. When you take the 173 countries covered by the report, it turns out that in essentially half of them, at least one absolutely pivotal element of democracy which in some cases might be the ability to hold credible elections, in some cases might be the protection of freedom of expression, in some cases it might be the quality of civic space. It varies according to the country. But at least one pivotal element of democracy has deteriorated in a very significant way over the previous 5 years. When you go back in time a decade, it turns out that what is now half of the countries covered by the report used to be 10 years ago less than a quarter. So that alone tells you how widespread the process of deterioration in the quality of democratic governance is and how rapidly it is advancing. We can go into a very complicated and frankly unclear at this point discussion as to why this is happening. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you one aspect of this toxic brew that is generating these very problematic aspects. The international environment for the protection of democracy has changed dramatically over the past generation. And regimes like the military regime in Myanmar pay much less of a cost for their democratic transgressions than it was the case a generation ago. And there are many reasons for that, but this is something that we're seeing all over the place. I mean, the sheer impunity with which regimes of different kinds trample on democracy. You know, I as I mentioned, I come from Costa Rica. We live next door to Nicaragua. I mean, Nicaragua is a case in point where a democracy has been destroyed in full daylight.
Yeah.
Right? And without the regime paying any obvious price for that. I mean, regimes like the regime in Myanmar or the Ortega regime in Nicaragua nowadays have a supporting structure around them that allows them to withstand pressure from their own people in a way that wasn't the case before. Not just pressure from their own people, pressure from other countries. I mean, the diplomatic pressure is something that they can handle in a much better way than used to be the case a generation ago. And this has made for a very, very challenging set of circumstances for democratic forces fighting against authoritarianism. But of course, you know, this is something that we see in the case of Myanmar, we see in other cases, and that, you know, makes for, I guess, is one of the reasons why democratic forces in a place like Myanmar deserve all the support that they can have, because they are fighting against enormous odds. Even in a case like Myanmar, where the regime appears to be generally vulnerable, yeah. You know, when you look at the statistics, when you look at the fact that the regime today controls, I don't know, about a third of the national territory, when you look at the economic collapse that is happening in Myanmar, when you look at the collapse of public services, when you look at the ostensible fact that the regime is not providing any kind of, you know, public service and public good that that their people expect, when you look at all these facts, one can see the vulnerability of the military regime in Myanmar, and yet it is still standing. So that tells you that the international environment is not having, you know, a positive effect in the struggle of the people of Myanmar for democracy.
Right. In segueing to the next question, I want to bring in another personal anecdote that again comes from Costa Rica, because as you were talking, this was crystallizing in my mind and its relevance to where you were going. And that's that, as I mentioned, I was in this small village in Costa Rica, and we were training teachers from around the region of Latin America. And in one case, we had I was walking down the small village road with a teacher from Nicaragua. And as we passed one of the homes, I think a football soccer game was on, and they just kind of waved to us, and we walked in and had a cup of water, sat down with them for a half hour, watched some game and came out. And the next day, the teacher from Nicaragua came in and said to me, I haven't been able to stop thinking about that experience. I've never had an experience like that in my life. And I said, well, what do you mean? What was so interesting about it? And he said, in my country, you would never call on the street to a stranger walking outside on the road and bring them into your house and have them sit down in your living room and watch a game. And this just tells me how different our societies are. And then, of course, the implication coming from the political governance and the safety and everything else. And so, and the reason why I'm sharing this anecdote is because this kind of bird's eye view that you gave, I think it's so important to balance that with the individual humanistic examples of what these systems are actually doing on the ground, in the sense of someone from one country side by side stepping across the border and just being so shocked by the experience of safely being invited into a stranger's home because the society and the political conditions allow for that kind of interaction and friendship. Exactly. and safety. You know, this is just really, really highlighting the real implications that it's having on a very human level. And then moving there to looking at what's happening in Myanmar and what the international community could do. You know, the question that I had prepared and the question that I was going to ask was the standard, you know, what can the international community do to help? What can ASEAN do? What can UN do? What can the West do? On this podcast platform, we've spoken with multiple people from across those organizations, and we've asked that question time and time again. And so the question I would reframe, and it's actually what I just mentioned about 10 minutes ago, was this statement from James Rodehaver saying that, from the UN, saying that it was so distressing to him because Myanmar was the one crisis where there are very tangible things that the international community can do. And we have gotten on record from several guests across, you know, ASEAN, UN, former ambassadors, et cetera, of do this and this and this. These are manageable, practical, applicable things that would make a difference and would make a huge difference, unlike the other crises where no one really knows what to do. And so I want to pivot from the standard question of what should the international community be doing, because we've heard all of that, into this question, referring back to what you said, that there are less consequences for these types of behavior than we've seen in previous generations, and they're able to get away with it. And so that's talking about both the lack of political will, as well as the change in the democratic culture and climate of the international community. And so I think that's a better prompt to the question of what we're seeing that the international community can or should or is capable of doing given these conditions.
I mean, look, there are at least a few concrete questions that should be tackled, you know, concrete issues that we should keep in mind, you know, things that can be done. I mean, number one, and at a most basic level, keep an eye on this. I mean, don't forget about the tragedy of Myanmar. And this is, as I said, part of what we're doing. You know, it to some extent is up to us to make sure that this is not forgotten. Number two, if you ask me, I find it absolutely baffling why democratic governments around the world have not decided to recognize the legitimate authorities that emerge from the last election that took place. Mm. The NUG and the CRPH. I mean, for the life of me, I fail to understand why no one has been willing to say what we all know, that they are the legitimate representatives mm. of the people in Myanmar. And number three, and this is crucial, as we know, the military regime is planning to hold an election at the end of the year. This is a phony election. This is an election that almost certainly will not meet with any kind of democratic standard worthy of the name. So I'm certainly hoping that the international community, well, the neighboring countries, but also further afield, will think twice about lending support to what in every possible way is an exercise to sanitize and legitimize an unconstitutional and illegitimate military takeover. I mean, look, the fundamental message here, and this is something, again, that I've seen from very close quarters here, is this is an immensely brave people fighting for a cause that we all profess to support against very difficult odds. So I would hope that we don't lose sight that the struggle for democracy is never easy and is never linear. That in most cases is a protracted process where at many points along the road the odds look impossible, and then eventually there's a breakthrough. So we are at one of those moments, and we should keep at it, and we should try to support the enormous courage of the people, particularly the young people in Myanmar, because they are fighting for something that is bigger than them, bigger than Myanmar, and bigger than each of us. I mean, they are fighting for values that, in the case of international idea, are the reason why we do this work. I mean, because presumably we are fighting for the only political arrangement that guarantees that the fundamental dignity of people is protected. So this is a cause that concerns all of us. And they're on the front line and fighting for us. And it's our duty to support them.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And on behalf of, I think, many people listening, I just want to thank you and your team for all you've done and have been doing for Myanmar. Sometimes the people there do feel quite alone and quite forgotten. And I think interviews like this are so important to remember how many people around the world are doing to keep what they're doing alive, and very reciprocal, not just giving out to help those, but how much inspiration and encouragement that people like us are gaining by seeing those on the front line of this battle of freedom and democracy, how much they're giving and how much they're showing us through their courage and dedication that can then inspire us in everything we do in very different contexts.
My pleasure.
Before we sign off, I just want to take this opportunity to sincerely thank those of you who have chosen to contribute to our wider Better Burma nonprofit mission. In addition to supporting our humanitarian work, we simply could not continue to provide you with the content and information through our podcast channel without the wonderful support of generous donors, listeners, and friends like you. Each episode provides access to one more voice, one more perspective, one more insight. Every donation of any size is greatly appreciated and helps us to continue this mission. So we take this time to say thank you. To find out how you can contribute today, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation.